Good morning. It's great to be here. We've got another beautiful day, beautiful setting, beautiful campus, beautiful city. I'm not sure anybody's got it better than we do today, right? Okay, what I'm going to do today is give you something of an overview of church and state in the United States. Many of you are not from this country, and you maybe don't understand the system too well. I have found that many people outside the United States typically will stereotype our system as being one of strict separation of church and state. Well, one of the things that I would hope to do today would be to convince you that it's far from this. In some ways, our system is dripping with religion. But I think it's a beautiful system. I'm a very strong proponent of our system, a big fan of our system. It's not simple, which actually I'm very proud of. It's very complex. But to me, it makes it all the more beautiful. But because it is complex, a lot of people are sort of bogged down by a lot of the contradictions that you see, the anomalies in the system that you see. And from a distance, for a lot of people, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. I used to experience this with a lot of students, particularly undergraduate students. And they'd go through a whole course, and they would come to me, and they would say that I just don't really understand all of these conflicts. So this talk is in some ways an attempt to try to explain some of these conflicts. Hopefully you'll know more when you leave today than you do now. If you don't, I'll take responsibility for that, but perhaps next year I'll just tell Cole to do it himself. Okay. All right. There are a lot of inconsistencies. For example, we have no classroom prayers permitted. Prayers before athletic events, nor prayers at graduation ceremonies, but the Senate and the House of Representatives have chaplains who lead prayers and other spiritual guidance to members and their families on a regular basis. This doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. Is this separation of church and state when we have these chaplains on a regular basis in various legislatures, including the Senate and the House, leading prayer on a regular basis? Another inconsistency, the Ten Commandments cannot be posted in the classroom or public buildings, but the Supreme Court has a fresco of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. Actually, the Supreme Court building is laden with all kinds of representations of the Ten Commandments. There's not only a fresco up here at the top on this panel, which is an overall presentation of lawgivers throughout history, but the Ten Commandments you'll also find on the doors as you each door. Left and right as you enter the Supreme Court chambers. It's also on the outside of the building. But, of course, we have restrictions in our public schools about posting the Ten Commandments in particular. Another inconsistency would be that we have ordained ministers who can run for a presidential election. This is not the case in some countries, and some people are confused by the fact that we have or announce or espouse a separation of church and state, yet we permit religious personnel, clergy, to actually run for high office. So how do we overcome some of these inconsistencies? Well, I would suggest to you that the American system of government employs three distinct yet interrelated sets of rules. We do have, in some cases, a very strong sense of the separation of church and state. There's no question about that. But we also have what I would call an integration of religion and politics. And we also have what I would call an accommodation of civil religion. Actually, I could add to this list at least one more, maybe more. I could add probably what would be called an accommodation of secular and religious, or secular and sacred. But just to keep it short and keep it simple, we'll stay with these three items as part of an overall taxonomy to explain the system. I'm not suggesting that this is the best way to explain the system or the only way to explain the system. I just found that it's helpful to students in particular to explain the overall system. First, with regard to the separation of church and state, this has become the customary way of describing the relationship between religion and state in the American system, yet the phrase is obviously too broad to accurately describe the whole system because in many respects there clearly is no separation. I mean, we've already seen some inconsistencies. Another inconsistency would be our national motto, which is "In God We Trust." Well, how does this represent the separation of church and state when our motto is "In God We Trust" and we plaster it all over our money? but obviously, the separation of church and state does not describe the entire system. This happens to be, by the way, a document written by Thomas Jefferson, in which he used the term separation of church and state as a way to describe the American system back in the early 19th century. This is a copy of our Constitution, or at least the first page of our Constitution. But when we talk about the separation of church and state, a better way to think of separation is as a term that describes an institutional separation of church and state. In other words, the Constitution requires that the institutions of church and state in American society not be interconnected, dependent upon, or functionally related to each other. So usually, and most of you know this by now, if you've been here a couple of days and listened to some of the American speakers, you know that we have a First Amendment that contains an Establishment Clause and a Free Exercise Clause. These 16 words are basically the basis upon which all of our courts adjudicate probably 90 to 95% of every case that has anything to do with religion. So in virtually every case, we're trying to make a determination as to whether a particular practice is acceptable or unacceptable, depending on or based on the wording of the First Amendment. But it is an institutional separation only. It doesn't mean that religion is excluded. As I said earlier, religion is, it flowers our entire system and actually makes it a much more beautiful system in my view. But religion is very much a part of it. And these three components that I wish to present to you today are simply ways to show you in which we do actually retreat quite liberally at times from a strict separation of church and state. But there are controversies when we talk about church-state separation. I would suggest to you that in many respects, one area in which we do more closely than in many other areas observe a separation of church and state would be in the public schools. Teachers, other school personnel are not permitted to lead vocal prayer in public schools with students. We do permit students to pray privately. Many of the states now have legislation to provide for a moment of silent prayer when everyone can take a minute at the beginning of the day and pray or literally prepare themselves for the day or do anything else that they wish to do. We don't allow, as I said, the posting of the Ten Commandments. We don't allow verbal recitation of the Lord's Prayer. Of course, a lot of these things are very upsetting to a lot of people. I mean, I'm not suggesting to you that these things are not controversial, right? They're very, very controversial. This picture that you have here of Barack Obama, I'm not sure exactly what he's doing here. It looks like he's got his hands folded and he's leading in prayer. I'm not sure what she's doing. Maybe she, like many Americans, is celebrating the fact that he's breaking the rules and he's leading the classroom in prayer. I don't really know. I don't know when this was taken. I assume it wasn't taken directly after the last debate between Romney and Barack Obama. But there are all kinds of issues. I never cease to be amazed at the kinds of issues that come up with regard to the matter of religion and the public schools. There are, you know, dozens of pending cases right now. I was reading just the other day about one that's fairly new that looks like it might be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court that occurred in South Carolina. The situation was there. We have what we call a release time concept. And this actually goes back to 1948 when we had a case called McCollum versus Board of Education. And the city of Champaign, Illinois, their public schools had adopted a practice, actually had been a practice for most of the 20th century, of bringing in, during 1 hour of the day, representatives from the city's clergy. You had a Jewish rabbi, you had a Catholic priest, and then you had a Protestant minister come in. And the kids who wanted to go be instructed about religion could go to that particular class. Well, the Supreme Court said, we don't allow this, okay? This is a violation of the Establishment Clause. This looks like the school system is advocating or promulgating religion. Our governmental agencies, including our public schools, are not supposed to be religious advocates, so this is not something that's permissible. Now, 4 years later, in the case of Zorak versus Clausen, the court said, if you send the students off of the school campus, it's okay. You can then have religious personnel instruct the students in a religious class, and then you bring them back to the school. Well, some thought this was a difference without a distinction, or a distinction without a difference, but in any case, that practice was upheld. Now, interestingly enough, in South Carolina right now, there's three cities, Myrtle Beach, Greenville, and Spartanburg, thank you. Spartanburg is actually in the title of the case, right? Yeah. Okay. The practice there is they have decided to use this release time concept, but in addition, they are now giving credit to the students for taking a course in religion away from the campus. And the question is, does this add something that would make the practice unconstitutional, a violation of the Establishment Clause? And the Fourth Circuit, I believe it was, held that this was not a violation, that this was consistent with the Zorak case. But as I said, this may be appealed. I think the Freedom From Religion Foundation is actually a party to the suit, and they probably will appeal it. We used to see also in the area of government aid to private schools a very strong separation of church and state. That's really not true so much anymore. We don't really have time to go into that, but those rules have been considerably relaxed so that there are some ways to get aid of various kinds to private religious schools. Faith-based social services, which is a practice that we have of having churches and other religious institutions engage in all kinds of social projects, which in theory at least are secular projects. Feeding the poor, providing a soup kitchen, a clothing pantry, or something like this. Again, the rules here have been relaxed, and we don't really have time to go into that. Moving to the second description, this would be the integration of religion and politics. And again, I would suggest to you that this is kind of an exception. It's a relaxation of the strict rules about separation of church and state. So here the American system allows for the participation of all people in political discourse, regardless of religious belief. Complete separation would not allow for such participation. This is a statement by Justice Berger in the Walls case, 1970, that I won't take the time to read it, that basically approves the notion that we permit religious persons, religious groups, and organizations to engage in political discourse and offer all kinds of religious arguments, religious language that they want for the advocacy of law and public policy. This is another similar statement. I'll skip over that. It's not only a practice that we have that allows the people to engage in religious arguments in public discourse, which again, many people would see to be a violation of the separation of church and state, but I'm suggesting to you that in this case, we sort of make the rule that democracy trumps the separation of church and state. And so we allow the participation of all citizens, including highly religious persons, to engage in public debate about things. But we also permit our candidates for various public office to engage in religious discourse. This is a country that I think would never elect, at least not today, an avowed atheist as president. The American people always want to know the religious views of political candidates, and this is certainly true in the current run-up to the November election for president. The sole provision about religion in our Constitution is that we have a provision that prohibits the administration of a religious oath to hold public office. So such a religious test is officially prohibited, but as I was just saying, it's unofficially required. We expect to know and want to know and actually demand to know what the religious views are of our candidates. The religious views of many of our candidates throughout history have been very, very controversial. Here I name just a few. Thomas Jefferson, of course, was not a traditional or orthodox with a small O Christian. He was very much a deist. Al Smith, in I think it was the 1928 election, was a Catholic, which was very, very controversial at the time. But he also kind of had a communist platform. His views were very controversial. John F. Kennedy was our first Catholic president. George Bush was well known for being a very strong evangelical. And Barack Obama has created a lot of controversy, of course, with his religious views. He claims to be a Christian. I tend to take him at his word. But he attended a very progressive, liberal type of church for quite some time before becoming president. He does have a Muslim background. He's widely criticized, excoriated by many people who think that he's just a closet Muslim and nothing else. I tend to think that with a Muslim background, he knows a lot about Islam that most of us don't know, and he can actually bring something that other candidates couldn't bring to the office. So someone who's schooled in not only Islam but also Christianity, you would think with the separation of church and state in a country that promotes religious pluralism would be an advantage, but for many, it's an automatic disqualifier to be president. The last category would be, how am I doing on time, Alan? 2 or 3 minutes? Okay. Here we have the accommodation of civil religion. Civil religion is about those public rituals that express the nexus of the political order to the divine reality. It's a form of religion which gives sacred life to, or sacred meaning to national life. It's sort of the way that we give a religious dimension to our public life. Most Americans are religious. Every poll suggests that at least 85% of Americans are religious. And there's a sense in which we think that not only are we as individuals accountable to God, but everything, including our nation, every nation, would be accountable to God. So for most Americans, it makes no sense to separate church and state completely. They want a system in which there is some religious aspect or some religious dimension to our national life. So in this way, we adopt a number of symbols and practices that express this. I've already mentioned the fact that we have a national motto, "In God We Trust." It's not "In Jesus We Trust" or "In Allah We Trust" or "In Horus, the Egyptian god that we trust." It's in the most generic, broad term that we have for the divine reality, and that is God. So hopefully this is a very broad-based sort of motto that many people could tap into from different religious traditions. Another symbol of our civil religion would be the Pledge of Allegiance. This is a pledge that most of our public school students recite every morning that does invoke the name of God with the phrase "under God" that was added to the pledge back in the 1950s. We have a National Day of Prayer, which is observed on the first Thursday of each May. We have done this. Actually, we started the practice in 1948 under Harry Truman. The first Thursday of each May was designated to be the National Day of Prayer during the administration of the first George Bush. Officially paid chaplains in legislatures, local government, and military. This would be another aspect of our civil religion. It's become very commonplace for our office holders, particularly presidents, to make allusions to God and America's religious destiny in their presidential speeches. Here you see George Bush doing exactly this. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized civil religion. Prayer in the legislature, they basically have referred to as being kind of a form of civil religion. The Supreme Court doesn't tend to use the term civil religion, which is more something that you see historically in a lot of literature. You'll see civil religion talked about by people as far back as Plato and Aristotle. Rousseau, in French history, was well known for being a strong proponent of civil religion. But the posting of the Ten Commandments would be something that the Supreme Court has approved. The Supreme Court tends to use a term they call ceremonial deism, which is probably something equivalent to what we're calling civil religion. Legislative and military chaplains, holiday displays, which have secular content, would be a part of our civil religion. The Supreme Court has found legislative prayer to be permissible under the long-held traditions of our country. However, prayer in the public school classrooms, again, during graduation ceremonies or before athletic contests, is understood to violate the First Amendment. It's very, very difficult to go through all these cases and make some rules or identify some rules as to what they will uphold as being a civil religious practice versus what is struck down as being a violation of the separation of church and state. But the best that I can tell is that when they see something that they think violates the sensibilities of our youth, they're likely to say that this practice is a violation of the separation of church and state, like public school classroom. Also, they tend to say that when a practice is longstanding, such as our practice of having legislative chaplains, they would tend to approve that as being something like ceremonial deism or civil religion. Also, if a practice is found by the court to be generic, they will usually approve that, something like our national motto, which I've already suggested to you is a very generic statement. An official civil religion, who defines the contours of the religion? Well, nobody really does. It defines itself. Robert Bellah, back in the 1960s, became the primary articulator about the American civil religion, and he was very good about describing it as being something that had its own tenets. It has its own leader, its own president, so to speak, who is the president of the United States, or its own clergy. It has its own hymnology, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, America the Beautiful, the Star-Spangled Banner. It has its own scripture, which would be the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, maybe the Gettysburg Address. Is that you telling me that to sit down?
It's not me.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'll sit down in 1 minute. I'm just about done. Does it violate the First Amendment? The court has officially said no, and they even had a little bit of discussion about the concept of civil religion in the Weissman case in 1992. Is civil religion a threat to authentic religion? Some people say that it is. I mean, some people say that it's a separate kind of religion. It doesn't really blend with other things. I mean, the distinction is lost on many, many people. There are many Americans who see no difference in civil religion and their own religious set of beliefs. But for some, it is a competing kind of religion that does have its own tenets. And those who practice civil religion are actually practicing something that's blasphemous, that's idolatrous. So for them, it is a threat to authentic religion. But in conclusion, I would suggest to you that the separation of church and state, integration of religion and politics, and accommodation of civil religion all blend together in the American system to construct what we could call the good society. It's a model of democracy at work. There's something in the system for everybody, liberals, conservatives, separationists, non-separationists, etc. Thank you very much.